From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, as the legislature moves to pass voter restriction bills, other GOP-controlled states are doing the same. Where do these proposed laws come from? Who is pulling the strings? And the deadly January 6th domestic terrorism attack on the U.S. Capitol, did we almost lose our democracy that day?
When a crowd breaks into Congress chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," because he is going to perform essentially a paperwork function that confirms what we already know, which is that Biden won the election, it is hugely important to remember that the common organizing purpose of the rioters was to keep Trump the president and prevent Biden from being president.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. As Senate Bill 7, the Texas voter restriction bill, worked its way through the state legislature, we were told by state leaders like Governor Greg Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, that this drive to make voting more difficult in the name of election security, it was all a Texas effort and not connected to a national agenda or even a response to President Trump's re-election defeat. That claim was shaky to begin with because so many Republican-controlled states were driving the same kind of bills, using the same sort of language and public justifications. It all looked coordinated. But now we know it was coordinated, and now we know who was calling the tune. Leaked video from a dark money group tells us how they did it. Jessica Anderson, the executive director of Heritage Action for America, a sister organization of the Heritage Foundation, is on camera bragging about writing these GOP voter suppression bills and controlling the optics to get them passed into law.
We're working with these state legislators to make sure they have all of the information they need to draft the bills. In some cases, we actually draft them for them, or we have a sentinel on our behalf give them the model legislation. So it has that grassroots, you know, from the bottom up type of vibe.
The scoop is from Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America.
What we learned is that Heritage Action for America, one of the most influential conservative groups, the sister organization of the Heritage Foundation, says they have written what they call model legislation in terms of bills that would restrict voting access in states like Texas and Georgia and Iowa. And they give a very detailed account of provisions that they wrote. They say that they wrote 19 provisions in a Texas House bill, HB 6, which is now, of course, SB 7. They say that they wrote 8 key provisions of a Georgia bill. They say they wrote 3 provisions of an Iowa bill. And so this gives a lot more detail of a role of a very influential conservative group in supposedly writing legislation about voting access in critical battleground states.
We saw that states, Florida, Georgia, Arizona, Texas, other states doing pretty much the same thing at the same time. We had a hunch that this was coordinated, but now we know who's pulling the strings.
Well, according to Heritage Action, they are pulling the strings. I mean, they are saying they are coordinating this effort. They are saying that they are writing this model legislation. They are saying that the model legislation incorporates key principles that they've put out, things like making it harder to vote by mail, eliminating or severely restricting mail ballot drop boxes, preventing election officials from sending out absentee ballot requests, preventing election officials from accepting private funding. Things like that are in a lot of different bills. They're in the Georgia bill, they're in the Arizona bill, they're in the Florida bill, they're in parts of the Texas bill. So the fact that we've seen so many states pass or consider new restrictions on voting in such a short period of time, and that the legislation is so similar in many cases, led me to believe that someone was helping to orchestrate this effort. And Heritage says they're orchestrating it, and they're spending $24 million over the next 2 years in 8 states to do this. And they also lead a call every Tuesday with other top conservative groups where they coordinate the agenda for that week when it comes to passing this legislation.
In Texas, hearing from our lawmakers as they push through SB 7 through the legislature, they were telling me in my reporting, this was something that was created locally to deal with a local problem. It had nothing to do with Donald Trump's failure to be reelected. It had nothing to do with the national elections. This is just Texas stuff. And now we know that that was smoke and mirrors, that this leaked video blows out the smoke and shatters the mirrors. Is that right?
Well, what Heritage is saying is they are coordinating a national effort that is being exported to the states to write model legislation restricting voting access. They say, Jessica Anderson, who's the executive director of Heritage Action for America, she says in this leaked video that we obtained, in some cases, we actually draft them, she's talking about the bills, for the legislatures, or we have a sentinel on our behalf, give them the model legislation so it has that grassroots from the bottom up type vibe. So clearly it's a big national organization coordinating with other national organizations to try to write legislation in places like Georgia, Texas, Arizona, Florida, Iowa, et cetera. And she clearly says that this is about the November election. Jessica Anderson, the ED of Heritage Action for America, says that she wants to right the wrongs of November. And Hans von Spakovsky, another expert who's quoted in this video from the Heritage Foundation, says that the one good thing that came out of November is the fact that so many state legislators realize they have to fix the problems that occurred. So what they're doing, the legislation they're pushing, is a direct result of the unfounded claims about voter fraud that many Republicans, including in Texas, circulated about the 2020 election.
Is there anything illegal or improper about this?
That's a difficult question. I don't believe so, but it remains to be seen. We just received some feedback from Iowa Republicans who are denying that Heritage Action wrote parts of the bill there. And they claim that it could be a potential ethics violation from Heritage if, in fact, they claim credit for a bill that they didn't write. So this could go both ways. They could be in jeopardy potentially for writing legislation if they violate state ethics laws, or they could potentially be in violation for claiming credit for things that they're not actually doing. But to me, it was less about the legality of it and more just about you have a huge conservative group that's funded with millions of dollars in secret donations. We know very, very little about who's behind this campaign, who's funding this campaign, writing legislation for states that they claim to be doing to respond to their constituents. And maybe the legislators in Texas and other states are responding to their constituents. But it's also very clear from this video that very influential organizations are pushing them to do this and trying to export a Washington-based agenda, a very ideological one, to the states.
Does it seem that the Heritage Action, that they are have identified this key vulnerability in the U.S. election system, that we have national elections, but they're run on a state-by-state basis, and that if you're able to do this state-by-state coordinated effort to weaken election laws, then you can weaken overall American democracy. So there should be some sort of federal response to that.
Yes, and that's the interesting thing, is that Heritage is leading the effort to block the federal response to voter suppression. They are leading the effort to block H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which would preempt many of these voter suppression policies by putting in place things like election day registration and automatic registration and 2 weeks of early voting and expanded mail voting, a lot of policies which states like Texas don't have in place currently. And Jessica Anderson, the ED of Heritage Action for America, says that if this bill passes, we lose our republic, period. So she's talked about it in very apocalyptic terms. Now, when I talked to voting rights advocates, they said that the fact that you have a dark money group funding voter suppression is the exact reason why we need the For the People Act, because that act would address both dark money and voter suppression, that these issues are intertwined. And I think that was one of my key takeaways from the video, that the same people that are funded by millions of dollars in secret money are also the same people that are trying to make it harder to vote.
If these bills are passed, like in Texas and other states, will this give a tactical advantage to the Republican Party?
I think there's no doubt about it that if these bills are passed, they'll give a tactical advantage to the Republican Party. I believe that's the only reason they're trying to pass this legislation. You look at things like in SB 7, where they're trying to ban drive-through voting or curbside voting or extended voting hours. These were things that were disproportionately used by voters of color that are more likely to benefit Democratic candidates. These are the things that increased turnout in places like Harris County to historic levels. But I will also say lots of Republicans benefited from these policies too. Lots of Republicans used things like drive-through voting or extended voting or curbside voting. Lots of Republicans got absentee ballot applications if they wanted to. So I think there's going to be some collateral damage here as well. And that's why I think when we talk about voting, I don't think we should talk about it strictly in partisan terms, because this is going to restrict voting access for all Texans or for all Georgians or for all Floridians. And yes, it might be done to benefit one party, but it's going to have an effect on a lot of different voters.
Right. So we do see coverage of this voter restriction bills that are being passed as in sort of painted in red versus blue terms. And I do think that not enough attention is paid to the fact that when we weaken democracy, we weaken America. It is weaker in the sense it's able to serve the country and those in need. It's also weakened to withstand external outside threats. In Texas, our grid failed. We have all sorts of problems with childhood poverty, healthcare, and it's because people who write the laws don't feel like they have to answer to the general public because they're shielded from them at the ballot box because of laws like this.
Exactly. Texas Republicans aren't addressing that the problems that Texans care about. And also, they do not represent the diversity of the state. Texas is a majority-minority state right now, where white people are in the minority, but you have a nearly all-white Republican Party controlling things. And Texas's voting system is so far behind so many other states. Texas doesn't even have online registration, which is one of the most basic things that 40-plus other states have. Texas is one of the only states that makes it incredibly difficult to vote by mail, that if you're under the age of 65, it's almost impossible to get an absentee ballot unless you're out of town or you have a physical illness or disability. And they wouldn't say that fear of contracting COVID qualified as a physical illness or disability, which was completely out of step by how many states, including many Republican-controlled states, treated mail voting. So if Texas Republicans wanted to address the voting system, the first thing I would do is enact online registration like 40 plus other states have, enact no excuse absentee voting like more than 30 plus states have, including a lot of conservative states like Georgia. I would make it dramatically easier to register to vote in Texas. You have to be deputized to register voters in Texas. So many things Texas Republicans are doing is completely out of step with policies in other states. So just if you took an objective look at Texas's voting laws, Texas ranked 44th in voter turnout in 2020, even when it had the highest turnout in 30 years in that state. If you just looked objectively at Texas's elections, you would say this is a state that needs to make it a lot easier to vote. And instead, they're trying to make it a lot harder to vote.
Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America.
Multiple capital injuries!
13-18. 12-5, and we're coming around from the south side.
That was a recording of the Capitol Police radio on January 6th as the officers were being attacked by a pro-Trump anti-democracy mob.
Intel, one be advised, you got a group of about 50 charging up the hill on the west front, just north of the stairs. They're approaching the wall now.
They're starting to dismantle their reviewing stands and throwing metal poles at us. 50, give me DSO up here now! DSO! Multiple law enforcement entries! DSO, get up here!
Alright, we're 30 seconds out.
Yeah, we need some reinforcements up here now. They're starting to pull the gates down. They're throwing metal poles at us. 50, DSO, get up here!
And here is what it sounded like on the ground as the mob pulled down a barricade and rushes the Capitol building.
Oh, 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 no, 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 no.
This week, during a congressional hearing, this is how Republican Representative Pat Fallon of Texas described what happened that day.
Was January 6th an insurrection, or could it be more accurately described as a mob of misfits committing disorderly conduct, violent entry, civil disorder, vandalism, unlawful entry, etc.? You know, the crimes that these people were actually charged with.
This is starkly different to how he explained that attack immediately after the event to WFAA-TV.
Because they breached right to the doors of the chamber, and they started banging on the doors. They're standing their ground. They're not going anywhere. And I said, you guys okay? And then they said, we're not leaving. I said, all right, I'm joining you. And then we started literally breaking off pieces of furniture make us clubs.
On Wednesday, Fallon joined other Republican congressmen who revised the history of January 6th.
It was Trump supporters who lost their lives that day, not Trump supporters who were taking the lives of others.
There was an undisciplined mob. There were some rioters and some who committed acts of vandalism. But let me be clear, there was no insurrection, and to call it an insurrection, in my opinion, is a bold-faced lie. Watching the TV footage of those who entered the Capitol and walked through Statuary Hall showed people in an orderly fashion staying between the stanchions and ropes, taking videos and pictures. You know, if you didn't know the TV footage was a video from January the 6th, you would actually think it was a normal tourist visit.
But here are the facts. On January 6th, following a Trump-attended Stop the Steal rally, a violent mob attacked the U.S. Capitol with the intent to overthrow the results of a fair election that Trump lost. Had they succeeded, it would have ended American democracy and ushered in a Trump dictatorship. And that battle to save American democracy continues to this day, as the Justice Department pursues those who were in the mob. Washington Post national security reporter Devlin Barrett joins us to explain an analysis of those charged so far in the January 6th attack.
The majority of these people were not part of a real organized group. A majority of these folks, a large majority of these folks, were what law enforcement sometimes refers to as free agents, meaning they were, you know, inspired, motivated, encouraged to go there and did, and according to prosecutors, engaged in crimes. But they were, you know, in a sense, radicalized that way. And one of the points that's been made to me in the reporting is, we don't really understand the radicalization process very well if this many people with no, you know, organizational framework behind it could engage in this much alleged lawbreaking.
Some of the assumptions that a lot of people had about these insurgents on January 6th is that they were uneducated, they were low income, and that they were dedicated to Donald Trump. What are you finding out as you look at the profiles of the individuals who have been identified and charged?
So I think a couple things. One, geographically, they're pretty much from all over America. This is not, you know, I think a lot of times our political discourse is about red states and blue states. These folks came from 44 of the 50 United States. So I don't think geography is really a driving factor in this. Certainly there are groups of people who travel together, but these folks really came from all over America. And economically and socially, it's a huge range of people. It's old people, it's young people, and everything in between. It's not... And there's small business owners, there's all sorts of variants in terms of their economic status and what they do in their normal lives. And so I really think that if you have a notion of a stereotypical, supporter of Trump, the folks who have been charged so far often do not fit that stereotype.
Of the folks who have been charged, what's their racial breakdown?
They're overwhelmingly white. That is certainly true. And they're very much a majority of men. A lot more men than women were arrested, but dozens of women were arrested as well. So it's not that there's no women being charged here, but it's overwhelmingly white, and a large majority of them are men.
I want to ask you about the gaslighting that we saw on the Capitol on this week. during the hearing. We heard from Republican congressmen describing this as just a bunch of good old boys, they're patriots who are on a tour, and that this is a media invention, and that nothing bad happened, and all the violence and confrontation came from the Capitol Police.
Right, and that's been, you know, right after January 6th, very few people were willing to make that argument in any part of politics. And since January 6th, what you've seen is more and more conservatives challenging not just what Democrats say about what happened on January 6th, but challenging what the video says about January 6th, what social media posts by the perpetrators themselves say about January 6th. And I think what you've seen is that for a number of conservatives in Congress who are still fiercely, fiercely loyal to Trump, there is a desire to sort of minimize this, what happened, and suggest that it wasn't as violent as people like to say. But look, the reality is there were a lot of people there and there were a lot of cameras there. It was incredibly violent. Not every minute, every place, but many places were incredibly violent for very long stretches. And I don't think any amount of sort of political repositioning erases those videos.
I've spoken to people, you know, across Texas, in rural areas, talking about this event, and their takeaway is, well, it wasn't that bad. These were good people that got sucked into a bad moment. This is not, doesn't it really tell us who these people are? They just got swept in, and we probably should just let it go.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a phenomenon of American life in the justice system. People often want to minimize the conduct of people that they are sympathetic with or people they agree with. You know, I've covered courts a long time, and that is not unique to this case. I often find that when someone sympathizes with another person who's been charged with a crime, they try to make it sound less bad than it was. I think what's difficult, though, in this case about those arguments is you have to ignore your eyes to sort of accept those arguments or adopt those arguments. There were clearly very many people who were engaged in tremendously violent attacks on police officers. Look, 75 people have been charged to date with assaulting police officers. That's an incredible number.
So were these people at the Capitol, were they radicalized? What does that mean? How did that happen? What does that tell us?
I think it's fair to say that most of the people at the Capitol were radicalized to the degree that they were willing to attack Congress. You know, Washington, D.C. has protests all the time. And sheer numbers, it's not like January 6th was larger than any previous protest that Washington has seen. In sheer numbers, January 6th was actually smaller than a lot of regular protests that happen in Washington. But what was different about January 6th was that a group of people, and law enforcement has estimated it to be about 800, a group of about 800 people out of that larger protest crowd decided to essentially break into Congress. And that's remarkable. We haven't seen anything like that before. And so I think radicalization is the right term for folks like that, particularly because when you look at some of these folks, they're not what you might think of as, you know, the law-breaking protester type. These are folks who are extremely supportive of Trump, were very angry that Biden had won the election and wanted to stop it, sure. But these were folks who were willing to take that anger and channel it into action against not just Congress, but police officers. And I think it's fair to call that radicalization. And I think it's a very important question to understand. How do you take, for example, a small business owner from California who decides to, you know, attack an officer in that moment? What is the thought process that leads someone to be willing to engage in violence like that?
And do it while chanting USA, thinking that you're there to defend the Constitution and that you're the patriot for trying to stop a peaceful transfer of power in an election. So did these people generally have a shared foundational belief in the big lie, the Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani story, that there was something wrong with our voting machines, that Dominion or Smartmatic had somehow switched votes, that there was bamboo in the ballots in Arizona, that they thought that there was something terribly wrong with our election, and that is why they had to do what they did.
Right. I think that's a very common view for a lot of those 800 people. And to be honest, I think it's a common view for a lot of the protesters who did not attack the Capitol. I think, you know, obviously the investigation is focused on the ones who engaged in crimes. And I think the view that the election was somehow stolen, even though, you know, for a lot of these folks, when you press them as to, well, exactly how do you think the election was stolen? The arguments don't really hang together. Obviously, the facts aren't there to support that claim, but the belief there is very, very strong. And I think that belief is a very common feature among them. But I also think that in some ways, the most common feature is just that they were not ready to accept Trump not being president. They thought that they might be able to keep Trump as president if they just fought hard enough.
Yeah. Do we need to keep that front of mind as we remember January 6th, that this was an attempt to overthrow democracy?
Oh, look, I think that's hugely important. I think, you know, when a crowd breaks into Congress chanting "Hang Mike Pence" because he is going to perform essentially a paperwork function that confirms what we already know, which is that Biden won the election. It is hugely important to remember that the purpose, the most common organizing purpose of the rioters was to keep Trump the president and prevent Biden from being president, because that motive is a very alarming and un-American and shocking thing to try to accomplish.
So we're in a different phase now with January 6th, and that is prosecution. How are things changing along those lines? How have people been charged? Do you think we're going to see a lot of guilty pleas?
I think we will see a lot of guilty pleas. We've already seen one. So by 100 days after January 6th, they had gotten their first guilty plea. And it's a significant one because it's a person who has a long affiliation with Oath Keepers. And it'll be interesting to see if he can shed any more light on exactly what the conversations were among Oath Keepers before January 6th, because that is obviously a hugely important part of this investigation in terms of understanding the degree of pre-planning and organizing that went into this. I also think there'll be a number of folks who decide to go to trial and fight their cases, in part because for some of these folks, some of the folks facing the stiffer felony charges, they face significant jail time. And for some of these folks, you know, there's a true believer element that to some degree they believe they, to your point about patriotism and saving the country, some of them have still believe very strongly that they did the right thing. And so it will be interesting to see how many of them decide to roll the dice with a jury trial, and which could end up leading to stiffer prison sentences if they get convicted.
Devlin Barrett is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters episodes to listen to. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.